You're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, which is your true community radio station. We want to thank everybody who participated in the fund drive. Stay tuned for a great edition of the Surreal News, your weapon of mass instruction, which is coming up next. Don't touch that dial. And again, I just want to thank everybody who participated in our fabulous fund drive, which went very well. We did exceed our goals. And thank everybody who contributed to all the shows. Well, in the studio, I have my favorite co-host of all time, Lou. Good morning, Lou.
Good morning, Steve.
All right. And then Tracy is our guest. Good morning, Tracy.
Good morning.
All right. Pull that a little closer to you. Let me see if I can get your levels a little bit better. Let's try that again. Say something.
Good morning.
That sounds good. All right. On the show this morning, we have Tracy
Ingram,
thank you, from Intention Technology. You're going to talk about tricorders. That should be really interesting. And then we have from Common Cause in Washington, D.C., the legal counsel of Common Cause, which is Steve Spaulding. We're going to talk about how government is supposed to work and some of the what's going on behind the scenes in the shutdown and the debt ceiling, et cetera, and we're going to take that apart. We have our Media Matters Minutes. We have lots of surreal news. Let's get going.
Surreal news for sure.
All right. Now, you're going to tell me about an edible boat? Really?
Boat? No, edible. This isn't just imagine.
Yes?
Sitting down with a cocktail only to find a tiny, brightly colored boat zipping around the surface. Either you really need to be cut off, or you're looking at a booze-powered cocktail boat invented by foodie scientists and other fruity garnishes, this one meant to be eaten. The boat idea first emerged when Lisa Burton, who was pursuing a PhD in mechanical engineering at MIT, our friends at MIT, and took a class taught by her advisor, fluid dynamicist John Bush. During the class, Burton learned about water-walking insects, which inspired her to construct the tiny fluid-propelled vessel with help from her friend, fellow mechanical engineer Nadia Chang. Apparently, the fluid boat is designed to have a hollow cavity in the middle and a slit in the back that allows the fluid that you pour in to escape. When the boat sits on water with an evaporative liquid streaming steadily out the back, the water acts like a rope, tugs the device forward, and that's because of greater surface tension with the water than the liquid food. Now, I mean, what they found out was that alcohol, though, was a great, evaporator.
Right.
You know, so
as you would expect,
as you would expect, and that the more potent the alcohol, the faster the boat moves. So apparently, cocktails made with Bacardi's 151, which is about 75% alcohol, really speed that little baby
now,
around.
This is not a
so it really is jet fuel then.
Actually,
there you go,
and that is jet fuel.
This is not a boat you can get in.
No, it is not
a boat that floats on your drink.
It floats
right?
on your drink.
Boat,
I guess if you could visualize one of those little martini glasses or something way more interesting than umbrellas.
Kind of reminds me of swamp coolers and how they work with evaporation and when they use those as air conditioning out west without air conditioning.
Actually, that's right. That's right.
All right, let me move on here and talk a little bit about air pollution. This is more serious. Subject here, and according to the WHO, air pollution causes cancer. Air pollution has been declared a carcinogen, like asbestos and tobacco and ultraviolet rays, by the International Agency for Research on Cancer. It's part of the WHO.
Go figure.
Air pollution is more important than passive smoking in terms of cancer-causing materials. More important than passive smoking, than secondhand smoke. Okay? According to the IARC, air pollution is a mixture of gases and particles. More things to come on that.
I guess in some parts of the world, they're going to have to outlaw breathing in restaurants, too, instead of just smoking.
Maybe so.
You know how they outlet smoke?
Depends on how bad their breath
because
is,
of passive smoke. I mean, it's worse than passive smoke, yeah.
All right, so post-traumatic stress is something that's been in the news a lot. We've reported it on
a
lot, Lou.
Yeah.
Okay, so people come back from the war. What's going on there?
Well, medical researchers say that they've discovered a possible vaccine for PTSD that could protect soldiers in battle by regulating one of the body's own hormones. Scientists, once again at MIT, reported in a new paper that ghrelin, a hormone produced during stressful situations, primes the brain for PTSD. They believe that controlling ghrelin can also prevent the formation of PTSD after traumatic events. During the experiments, the researchers found that when rats were given the drug to stimulate ghrelin levels in blood, they became much more susceptible to fear than normal rats. By blocking the receptors in these cells that interact with ghrelin, the researchers reduced fear to normal levels in the chronically stressed rats. One of the scientists, Gossens, said that the ghrelin operates alongside the brain's other fight-or-flight neurochemical system, which is controlled by the hormones cortisol and adrenaline. And that signaling route is known as the hypothalamus-pituitary-adrenal pathway, or the HPA. What we're suggesting is that the ghrelin pathway operates in parallel, Ghrelin said. We think that emotional disorders, such as PTSD, following traumatic exposure, are the result of elevated ghrelin rather than HPA. It gives us a completely new set of targets to treat PTSD. Now, of course, the best way to eliminate PTSD in soldiers is to quit sending them to war, yeah.
But keep in mind, also, you can get PTSD in other situations,
yes,
too.
You can, yes,
okay, it's not
yes.
unique to war. This is a
yeah, I know.
Where people experience experiences that are outside of their normal realm and they don't have the tools to experience that, then they can get the PTSD.
Incredibly stressful, being in a horrific accident or watching.
So this is potentially huge, because PTSD is very hard to treat, and it's a huge monetary problem for the vets. This is turning into quite a science show this morning, don't you think?
Yeah, so is this like a kind of a Botox for emotions now? I mean, are we at the point where we're actually kind of limiting their emotional range?
The thing with Botox is, though, that's an after the fact. This is before. So we're talking vaccine here.
Well, that's right? What they're saying, that this very well could be a vaccine. Mm. And apparently, they've tried to manipulate this hormone before, but for other reasons, actually, to reduce obesity, because apparently ghrelin, they had thought that, so there are some actual drugs on the market already. That's why they think that they can get this work
going
past the FDA fairly quickly, because
it's a fascinating area to work with. I mean, because you're dealing with these parts that we don't know about.
Exactly.
And that's where you get into the science of how we work. And that's what I'm fascinated with. And,
right.
And to really be able to get in there and look at a vaccine that could really help people, deal with reality.
Tracy Ingram has these great comments, and stay tuned, because in about 8 minutes we're going to be interviewing him about the tricorder. So you don't want to touch that dial. All right, let me just make sure that does not. Okay, I also want to report something that's going on worldwide, which is slavery, and also here in Florida, which we've reported on as well.
Yeah,
and that is millions are still slaves worldwide. Now, there's been some pieces on NPR about this too. The Global Slavery Index 2013 analyzes slavery in 162 countries, including the United States and Canada. All right, so in all, the report said about 30 million
amazing
worldwide are enslaved, more than the population of Texas. All right, the five worst countries are India, China, Pakistan, Nigeria, and Ethiopia. What's interesting about India is they have, even though they're the number one, they have a very small percentage of slavery in India.
Right.
It's just such a huge country.
Huge
the numbers
country,
get
right.
big.
Yeah, right.
Okay?
Right.
So, I forgot the name of the highest percentage was
Mauritania in West Africa,
which has the highest percentage
four
in our big history.
4% of its 3.8 million people are actual slaves. And they're not only slaves, but they're hereditary slaves. It's been going on for generations where people are like born into slavery and they don't know any better. And the owners, according to, the story that I have, buy, sell, rent out, or give away their slaves as gifts. you know, and it just it's you know, as they point out, I mean, as some people point out, you know, if you're born into slavery and you don't know any better, you don't even have to be chained. You don't even have to be locked up because you don't know any better. That's your life.
Now, on this show, we had the Immokalee workers in Jordan. Buckley was here and some of the other Interfaith Alliance. Right. And reporting, they have a slavery museum, which is a portable. It's a, I guess, a semi, whatever. And they go around Florida. And you can go in there and see what the living conditions are. This museum got rated the best museum in the country. It was rated higher than the Smithsonian at one point. I mean, this was big news. And slavery was active here in Florida, yes, and recently too. Okay, yeah. And this had to do with Publix and some of the growers that were contributing to Publix. They were convicted. Some of the growers were convicted of slavery. We're talking Immokalee right here in Florida, slavery.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean,
so if you think that this is old and, you know, bad, old news, nah, this is going on right now. All right, so that's some sort of not so good news. All right, tell me about my Oreos. I used to love those Oreos, taking them apart. Any problem with that?
Well, in Connecticut College, some students and a professor of psychology have found out that America's, and this is in quotes, favorite cookie, is just as addictive as cocaine.
Well, whoa.
Well, at least for lab rats. And like most humans, rats go for the middle first.
I love that.
Okay. You know, in a study...
Smart rats.
You know, in a study designated to shed light on the potential addictiveness of high-fat, high-sugar foods, Joseph Schroeder, assistant associate professor of psychology at Connecticut College and director of behavioral neuroscience program, and his students found rats formed an equally strong association between the pleasurable effects of eating Oreos in a specific environment as they did between cocaine or morphine in a specific environment. They also found that eating cookies activated more neurons in the brain's pleasure center than exposure to drugs or abuse. How about that? You know, I mean,
I stock an Oreo.
Well, I'll tell you what, though. You know, this explains a lot to me, because it's why I can't keep cookies in my house, because they last. I don't care how big the bag is; they're going to last like a day.
So you're not generalizing this.
You know, this is going to last a day.
You're saying now that
I go, that's all I'm going to have.
That's all cookies now, not just Oreos.
I think they use cookies. I think it's high fat, high sugar, and reading a little bit about this, you know. And other areas, yeah, it is actually sugar itself breeds, you know, sort of a, you know, once you get the taste in your mouth, you know, you can't quench that taste without more of it,
yeah.
You know, and that's why, you know, high sugar and fructose corn syrup and all those things, you know, are sort of at the root of our obesity problem in this country, because, you know, you don't ever get satisfied even though you're actually full.
So really one of the more powerful addictive drugs on the market that's not really regulated.
That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and it does have it
added to the list of what, caffeine, alcohol
can cause health problems.
Exactly.
Well, alcohol is somewhat regulated, right. I guess.
Right. And all of those things are not, because of the lack of regulation, we go, oh, well, it's okay. I can just have as much as I want, you know, and so it's not
exactly.
Stuff. Or, you know, you go to do the opposite where you go get the big hamburger and the Diet Coke.
Right.
I want, you know, I'm not sugar anymore.
Yeah,
so
right.
I can have as much as I want.
Right.
All right. So I have my next story here. I'm going to go international. I know we're kind of bouncing around here, and the headline here is that Saudi Arabia declines a United Nations Security Council seat. I also just want to mention, before I get into that story, there is an eclipse tonight. The peak of the eclipse is 7:50 p.m. tonight. If we have time, we'll come back to that. So for all you astronomers out there, myself included, eclipse, partial eclipse tonight. It's your prenumbral eclipse. But getting back to Saudi Arabia here, so there is a rotating seat on the UN Security Council, and Saudi Arabia said, no thank you. They think that there's double standards that make it hard for the world body to end conflicts and wars. And the kingdom, there's some quotes here, sees that the method and working mechanisms and the double standards in the Security Council prevent it from properly shouldering its responsibilities towards world world peace. And I can't help but sort of agree with you. The foreign ministry said in a statement carried by the news agency, they cited what was going on in Syria as an example of that. So the permanent nations, of course, Britain, France, Russia, China, United States, right. And then they have veto powers, and then other states are brought in on a rotating basis, right. But not Saudi Arabia. No,
not
thank
Saudi
you.
Arabia. Well, you know, Steve, you know, for whatever you can say about monarchies, they do run smoothly when there's only one guy at top and everybody's going to do what he says.
Yeah, and I guess the comment is people are more for strong and wrong.
Yeah.
Versus weak and right.
Yeah, there you go.
Strong and wrong wins, you know, time after time there.
There you go.
There you go.
We're just about to our first guest, but we got to talk about our favorite topic, 3D printers. How many 3D printer stories have we had so far? Boy, pizza and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
What are we printing now?
Pizza, ears, you know, we've done all kinds. Well, this one, the big thing about 3D printers now is that they figured out a way to do it with metal. They used to only be able to do it with plastic, but
right.
Now they can take a 3D printer, this is the next level, to create metal tools. And the guys that are doing this, their ultimate aim, I mean, this is, of course, has to do with space projects. Ultimate aim is to produce an entire satellite in a single piece, just one chunk of metal with no bolts or welds. You know, now what this basically does, is cuts waste down to absolutely zero. You know, as one of the guys points out, you know, you take a kilo of metal, you know, and you make something that's a kilo, there's no waste, basically, because there's no bolts, you know, and it's also much, much lighter when there's no bolts or screws.
Or seams.
So it's like, yeah, well, that's it. Seamless parts without using cumbersome screws and bolts, okay? And so, you know, it's basically a little ways away, you know, but the folks that are doing it is, you know, members of the project. They're called additive manufacturing, aiming towards zero waste and efficient production of high metal parts, also known as AMAZE. And they've already used 3D printing technology to create jet engine parts and aircraft.
Yeah. You could see in certain, like, high-stress situations, that could actually greatly improve the performance, like jet engines, things like that, where a little crack, something could be devastating, or certain types of buildings or support structures. Materials is so important.
You know,
so
welds are notorious. I mean, being, you know, limited to the skill of the welder, basically.
So this kind of reminds me, of Star Trek. Remember in Star Trek, you could push something in, usually food, right?
The replicator. That's right, yeah.
And then that leads right into the tricorder. Before we do that and talk to Tracy, I just want to remind everybody, you're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida. We are your true community radio station. We're it. There are others that say they are, but they're not. We're right here. We're not transmitting from Kansas City or something like that. And Surreal News, we're your weapon of mass instruction. I think rather than do the Media Matters Minutes, let's just jump right in and do that. And again, I just want to thank everybody last week that contributed to the fund drive. We did great. We met our goals, and we'll talk to you again in about 6 months. All right, Lou.
Well, as Steve has already mentioned.
Oh, and after Tracy is on, this is going to be a great interview. If any Star Trek fans, you're going to love it. But later on in the show, we have Steve Spaulding, who's the legal counsel for Common Cause in Washington, D.C., talking to us about how government works in the shutdown. And you don't want to miss that. That's coming up about 35 minutes past the hour. Okay, Lou.
Okay. Steve has already mentioned, we've got Tracy Ingram, who is founder and CEO of Intention Technology here in Sarasota, with us here in the studio. And recently, Intention was nominated to compete for the $10 million Qualcomm X Prize to be the first to build a working tricorder. Now, of course, we all remember the tricorder for all Star Trek fans was a thing. You know, Dr. Bones McCoy would, like, sweep over an alien or a crewman and immediately deduce what was wrong with him. Well, Tracy, tell us about yourself and tell us a little bit about Intention and how does this lead to the tricorder?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Lou. You know, I mean, a lot of my quest in medicine started because, you know, my mom was misdiagnosed and she spent over 2 years bedridden from a misdiagnosis. And what it did is it got me to start looking, you know, what else is out there? You know, our common, you know, Western medicine's been around for about 150 years, and what else is out there that could really lead us, you know, in that path? And so what I've done is actually worked with technologies all over the world and imported technologies that have amazing diagnostic capabilities but are not necessarily sanctioned yet by the FDA. And so what I've been really looking at is going, how do we bring those technologies to the mass public? And so the idea of the tricorder is a single device that has all of the world's medicine. It doesn't just have some of the world's medicine, but really looking at, you know, people have been around for a long time, and there's always been someone keeping them alive. And so before we had our modern medicine the way it is, people were still managed to stay alive. And so what we're looking at with the tricorder is, how do you create a device that has access to all the world's medicine? So what we've kind of, what we're working with, the technology is basically able to read the body. 80% of the communication is body language, and so what we're able to do is take all of those physiological cues and use it to diagnose symptoms and to really be able to send that information to really understand what's going on with somebody.
That's interesting. Now, you know, I saw your TED Talk, and I know you talked a little bit about this, and I never really realized this before. Maybe you could elaborate about how, you know, through our bodies, it runs electrical current all the time. You know, and that this is all about sort of measuring that electric current. Isn't that the whole field of biofeedback? I mean, isn't that kind of what that's about?
It is. It is. And, you know, I mean, to make it simple, you know, you all look, almost everyone understands what a defibrillator is. So in a situation where, you know, someone has a heart attack, you know, you take these paddles and you shock them with a whole bunch of voltage, you know, and it reboots them, kind of like rebooting a computer. But it's looking at what is the subtle energy that's going on in the body. What are the subtle communication pathways, and can they be measured? Some of this comes from Eastern medicine, where they believed in things like meridians, or, you know, even acupuncture follows some of this line.
Sure.
And so all of these lines of communication may have data on them. And so what we're really working on is being able to, you know, understand that language of the body and understand the electrical part of the body and how that information can be turned into data and how we can use that for diagnosis.
So actually seeing you know sort of developing a device that can sort of stimulate something that you can measure and then see what the actual real world result is and make a note of that and seeing if that can be repeated.
Right. You know? And see what that does is it starts giving us real time feedback.
Yeah.
And so much of testing and so much of diagnostics that we have now, or some of, you know, the tests that a doctor will give you, you know, someone has to interpret it, and you may get your results, you know, a couple days, a week, you know, and sometimes even later than that.
Yeah.
And to be able to have that real-time feedback where, you know, you go and you have an Oreo, right?
Right.
And and you can see what that's doing to your body. You can start seeing those changes in your metabolism. You start seeing the changes in the inside of your body in real time. And what happens is we're so disconnected from our bodies anymore, we don't have the experience of what is this really doing to me now. Everything's in the future.
Sure.
And so we're so disconnected with where we are, we don't actually get a chance to experience and to understand that. And so what we're really trying to do is give people back the awareness of their body. And so one piece of that is actually building this medical tricorder. Well, the reason that we came up with the term bioscanner, which is the project that Intention Technology is spearheading to fund and put together this tricorder, is in Star Trek lore, for those Trekkies out there in the audience, is the bioscanner was actually the piece that went into the tricorder that turned it from a scientific tricorder to a medical tricorder. It was also the piece that was in the ship so they could scan a planet to see if there was any alien life or anything like that.
That is right. Yeah, that is right. Because, I mean, the tricorder was like, it was like when Spock had it, it was the science tricorder, and he could, like, wave it over rocks and stuff. And
absolutely. You know, but so what they've done with the Qualcomm Tricorder X Prize, what they've done, you know, the X Prize was famous for the initial space flight, you know, to bring a ship up into space and back down and recycle it in 2 weeks, which was, you know, $10 million contest. You know, that the winner of that actually got bought up by Richard Branson, Virgin Galactic.
Right.
And so this one really, you know, is taking the best minds that are really out there looking at how do we solve this problem. Misdiagnosis counts for 460 deaths a day. And, you know, if we can come together, you know, between me and the other 41 teams that are left in the contest, to really be able to tackle this problem of misdiagnosis, can we create a situation where that doesn't have to happen anymore? And if I can just save one life, if I can stop, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning when some single mother's out there and they have to decide whether or not they have to go to the emergency room, which they can't afford,
right?
Or can stay home with their child, and to give them just a little peace of mind.
Sure.
that is worth it. And so that's really where we're at, is looking at how do we pull people together to be able to solve this problem. And a lot of where I came from was, you know, knowing that I've worked with technology that's been doing advanced diagnosis. I've been working with technology from Russia, China, Germany, all over Europe, and that I've had amazing levels of very acute, very, very detailed diagnoses within 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And so now it's trying to go, how do I make that technology more reliable? How do I make that technology more repeatable? How do I make it more accurate? And that's a thing that we have now, because 10, 20 years ago, we didn't have the digital signal processing we have today.
Sure.
We didn't have the advanced sensors. And to be able to take those advanced sensors matched with algorithms in the cloud to be able to do accurate readings on people and then to be able to fine-tune that technology, that's what we're working with.
You know, and also to make it, you know, a lot more available. I know you mentioned that there are only like 41 other companies, in the contest. I thought, you know, one of the things that I saw, did it start out as there was like 300 companies that were originally, you know, slated to, you know, compete in this?
It did. It's a worldwide contest.
Yeah.
And there was I think 200 and some, but
yeah,
around
yeah,
300
companies
that were all set out to do this. And, you know, a lot of them dropped out. You know, it was like, you know, because it's this impossible task of how do you diagnose anemia, how do you diagnose stroke, how do you diagnose melanoma, an ear infection, you know, and all of these very, you know, extreme symptoms and diagnosis, but also having all of the vitals from an ER. So measuring the blood pressure, the pulse, the respiratory rate, the temperature. And so what this does is it really takes all those, the time when you go to a doctor,
right,
the first 45 minutes you go in there, you're really sitting with the nurse, and they're going to take your vitals.
Right.
And they're going to give you a questionnaire, and they're going to go, what's wrong with you? And so, you know, and it's like, oh, well, I don't want to tell my doctor about that, and I'm not sure about this, and, you know, I've really been eating too many Oreos, but I don't want to tell them about that. But how do I go through that? Well, so what our device does is actually take that whole process and makes it digital. And it's not about what you're saying. It's about what your body's saying.
Great. You know, and also, too, I mean, just to, you know, I mean, clarify for, you know, our, you know, listeners, and I know you can, too, that, you know, to win this, quote, unquote, win this contest, there are, you know, a bunch of health metrics, which mm-hmm. you've already discussed, as well as being able to, this device is going to have to diagnose 15 different diseases,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I mean, and among those 15 different diseases, I guess, are some that you already mentioned, like
Absolutely.
Anemia and diabetes, and, you know, I'm sure. Or, you know, some sort of heart conditions.
Right. And so a lot of companies are coming at this from a lot of different directions. You know, we have some people who are doing genetics. We have some people who are doing blood testing. We're doing saliva testing. You know, there's a lot of different things that are coming at it. Where my background is understanding the body.
Okay.
And so what we're doing is taking a device, instead of building a separate test for every single one of those 15 diseases,
right,
what we're doing is building a platform that can be expanded. So in my experience in technology, in healthcare technology, is looking at scalability. And so I didn't want a device that could just diagnose the 15 things.
Right.
I'm looking at a device that can scale from the 15 to 100 to 1,000 to more, and have the same sensors that are readily available, a relatively inexpensive platform that could be deployed to third world countries. In areas where they don't have the high advanced technology, they don't have the MRIs or CAT scans. But if you look at, you know, healthcare technology as a whole, while we've had some really great devices come out, you know, all in all, healthcare has not advanced. You know, they're still trying to get digital health records in there. You know, often there's so many challenges with just a wrong signature from a doctor. You know, they do faxes. I mean, they're probably the only industry that still uses the fax machine as their number one tool of communication.
Wow.
You know, there was an analogy and a story about a, you know, if you go to an ER and say you're unconscious, that your used car salesman knows more about you than your doctor in the ER. Because your used car salesman, they know what you're wearing. They can see your shoes, they can run a credit report, and they have all that information about you. But if you're unconscious and you end up in the ER, the doctor knows nothing about you. And it's sad in a world like this that we have so much advanced technology that we can't give that to the people who need the help. And really, you know, I kind of find it as, you know, it's just a moral imperative to be able to go, if I have the technology that can help solve some of these problems, how can I not do it? And the XPRIZE, the Qualcomm Tricorder XPRIZE, gives us a great opportunity because the FDA is on board. It's qualified for the FDA fast track, and in fact, the FDA has actually joined in to say they've opened up a special help desk just for the teams in the contest.
That's great. That actually is an uncharacteristically compassionate and smooth thing for government to do. Speaking of the tricorder, I mean, I know there are some like physical limitations in this contest that it's got to be 5 pounds or less.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any you talk about gathering data from the body? How would that be done? I mean, obviously. Wouldn't be as slick as Dr. McCoy's tricorder, where you just like kind of wave it over the body and a bunch of lights kind of blink and go beep beep beep, and he looks down at it and he goes, oh yeah, obviously you're very messed up.
Right.
But
we're taking two approaches with that. One is we're actually looking at a long-term wearable type device that you could wear, but the initial part is a headset, because it's actually measuring heart rate, skin, and brain waves.
Okay.
And what we're able to do from that, and that then connects into a cell phone, and so a cell phone or an iPad. And so what we can do then is actually measure a lot of the vitals from the body, send that information to the phone, and then actually being able to do a diagnosis from that.
Through the headset, because you do have a pulse in your head, and it would get like the brain waves, and you would be able to measure. I mean, I would assume you'd be able to measure blood pressure that way also.
Absolutely. Blood pressure, skin conductance, all the electrical components that we talked about.
Okay.
I mean, all of those things are, a lot of it's right there in the head.
Okay.
Just to remind people again, you're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, your true community radio station. Tracy Ingram is with us, and we're talking about he's going to make a tricorder with his new technologies, Intention Technologies company. Lou?
Okay. Is there any kind of timeline, for this device? I mean, with you guys or with Qualcomm? I mean, do you guys have sort of unlimited time or?
No, it's actually we're coming towards the end of the contest. Actually, it's been going for a couple of years now. We got in a little bit later than some of the other teams. What spurred a lot of that on was bringing my TED talk, which actually brought a lot of people together to work on this project.
Great. Yeah.
The next deadline is actually coming up in March. We're going to go down from 41 teams to 10. And then from there, it goes into the hands of consumers, where consumers are actually going to get a chance to actually use the device and diagnose themselves. And that's really what the goal of this contest is to be able to create a device that consumers can do self-diagnosis.
So you actually must have a prototype by now.
Yes, we do. We do. Okay. We have a prototype and stuff. I didn't get a chance to bring it into the studio with us, but we got some really cool stuff going on.
I'd really like to have seen that. That would have been great. I wouldn't want to wear it because I don't want to know what's wrong with me. I don't have Obamacare yet, so I can't get it fixed.
Just a couple of comments, just the things I'm thinking about as I'm listening to you guys talking about this, which is fascinating. We did report that dogs can smell cancer, so that's interesting. And I imagine, you've seen a few of these articles, and you kind of look at that. This kind of reminds me of some evoked potential devices that we use in medicine. Also in electrical engineering, we have the idea of the impulse response. So let me just quickly explain that. If you take a system and shock it, it responds. Like if you take a bell and you hit it. If you hit a bell, supposedly, at least theoretically, you can tell everything about the bell, what's constructed of the material, where the crack is, how big it is, how heavy it is. It's called the impulse response.
Through its level of resonance.
Right?
Yeah.
And I guess we can sort of talk about this afterwards as well. And that is the idea of, now you have a spectrum of different types of energies, from low energies all the way to gamma rays and x-rays, et cetera, visible light, et cetera, and how you... the energy that you put into the system depends on what you get out, too, and that response. Some other things that I've been involved with in the past is Kirlian photography, which is high-voltage corona photography, where you take a object you're trying to image, and you put it in a high-voltage field of thousands of volts, and you see the aura or the corona, the field, is visible then to the visible eye of what surrounds that. And that was, for example, if you take a leaf and you cut a leaf and then you take the corona, you can see where the leaf was
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, was adopted by paranormal psychologists. And, you know, there's
sure.
a lot of pseudosciences associated with that. And actually, that was also looked into to see if they could figure out if integrated chips were being manufactured correctly on the assembly line, because silicon pretty close to carbon there. All right, so just a couple of comments I just wanted to share with you about my personal experience yeah. with sort of the tricorder
stuff.
Well,
and especially the comment you made about the dogs, you know, the sniffing cancer. I always thought that was interesting yeah. because, you know, they're able to understand something's going on with you without ever touching you. And it's like, you know, so when you start looking at, is there a system in the body that actually, like a check engine light, that says that something's wrong?
Yeah.
But maybe we don't pay attention. Maybe the aches and pains that we experience and the other things that are going on are our body's warning system to try to tell us what's going on, and we just don't listen. And so what we're doing is trying to bring people back to listening to exactly what's going on with them so that they can pick it up. And, you know, but I think that's fascinating. I mean, that was just actually on the nightly news about the dogs, you know,
right.
not only cancer, but other diseases.
Right.
Noticing when some people had diabetes and those things. And I think that's something that we all actually have, is that ability. It's just maybe it's latent and we don't actually necessarily listen to it.
Well, you know, I mean, to put things in the context of history and to sort of use, you know, sort of the Star Trek metaphor, Dr. McCoy would often derisively refer to the barbaric days when they actually had to open people up to look and see what was wrong with them, you know, and they didn't have tricorders, just like we look back at like, say, surgery that was done during, say, the Civil War and consider how barbaric it was to do surgery without anesthetic. You know, I mean, we are maybe perhaps coming to an age where, you know, as you accurately pointed out, diagnosis by physicians is probably, you know, their weakest suit. You know, I mean, I have some great friends who are doctors, not only Steve, but other friends, and I admire them, and they're dedicated, and they're mm-hmm. smart, and they work as hard as they can. But, you know, I have to say, you know, diagnosing problems, at least not so much in my situation, because knock on wood, I'm pretty healthy, but I mean, I went through both my dad and my mom helping them, is a real challenge sometimes, you know, whereas like the mechanical stuff, you know, like the orthopedic stuff, you know, fixing a knee, you know, yeah. you know, that's they're pretty good at that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was talking with a family doctor just the other day, and he had a very interesting story to share with me, because he says, you know, when someone comes into his office with strep throat, you know, or right. sore throat or something yeah. like that, it's pretty easy to go, okay, yeah, there's a sore throat, you know, antibiotics,
yeah.
no problem. And he says 9 times out of 10, that's exactly what's going on. I don't really need to spend any more time with them. They can just go on. It's that 1 time out of 10 that it's not strep throat, that they overlook it because it's so common. It's those 200 people that came into that office and it's like, oh, strep throat, strep throat, strep throat. It's that one time they go, it's strep throat, but it's not. And to really get something that's an early warning system to be able to give doctors the tools to go, oh, there's something else going on here. This is a complicated situation. It's not just a strep throat. And those, I think, are the tools that doctors are looking for to be able to do more of a triage, to be able to do more of, you know, the moving through the emergency room to be able to help people. And that's really what we're trying to do, is really not replace doctors, but give them the tools they need to be able to do their job.
And we will try to get back to some more of that later, but right now we're going to have a Media Matters Minute.
Good. All right, let's get to that, and then we have Steve Spaulding from Common Cause coming up in just a second.
This is the Media Matters Minute. During a report on the deal to end the government shutdown, Fox Business host Lou Dobbs downplayed the effects of the government shutdown on the U.S. economy.
The extent of just how much the economy suffered is questionable at best. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, for example, gained 1.5% since the partial government shutdown began 16 days ago. So with the bill expected to pass the Senate, and at any moment, Speaker Boehner is confident that he has the votes for passage later in the House.
But economists have reported that the government shutdown is projected to have significant negative effects on the economy. And CNN host Aaron Burnett showed Dobbs that it didn't take a business show host to correctly report on the shutdown's economic impact.
Whatever you think about spending, and say you 100% agree with the Tea Party on all of its points, which I know you don't, but let's just say you do, they still have to look in the mirror and say, we just cost this country $24 billion. That's the S&P estimate.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Media Matters, your nonprofit out of Washington, D.C., and you heard them reporting the media misinformation. Well, they were about the shutdown. And who better to talk to about that than Steve Spaulding, the legal counsel for Common Cause, who's joining us again this morning. Thank you, Stephen.
Hey, thanks. Happy to be here.
All right. So I guess just sort of an open question is, what's wrong with the government?
Well, what is that's a great question. I think what's not so wrong with the government is how it's structured. What the problem here is that it's kind of been infected and taken over by a minority of individuals that have used every means at their disposal to break government because they don't want government to work in the first place. I know we've talked at length about how they've done that with Senate rules, where one party gains a majority in the Senate and the minority just prevents the majority from acting at all by using 60-vote supermajority thresholds. But now we've seen them shut down the entire government because they lack the votes to repeal a law that they don't like, namely Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. And unfortunately, we've had leaders that are unwilling to stand up and let the democratic process work. You know, as we saw when the House finally voted to open the government and raise the debt ceiling, it gained a majority bipartisan support in the House. That could have been solved. What was a 16-day government shutdown? That could have happened, you know, at the beginning of the month on October 1st if Speaker Boehner had just let the House vote on the bill. But unfortunately, he refused to do that. He was listening to a band of 30 or so extremists in his caucus who were you know, objecting wildly to just putting a simple bill on the floor and letting the democratic process work, letting majority rule, which would have kept the government going. So we've seen this group that is, you know, they oppose government, period. You know, you've certainly heard Leader Reid call them anarchists. You know, I think he was being purposely provocative there, but they really do not like a strong you know, government that can solve national problems, and we've seen them grind the entire process to a halt.
You've commented in the past about the Senate and the filibuster and how that's been sort of perverted so that a small group of senators or even a single senator really can disrupt the workings of the government. Is something going on in the House now? I thought the House, you know, didn't have a filibuster, but we seem to have gotten stuck there. Wasn't there some rule that was changed about Cantor being the only one that could bring a bill to the floor?
There were a few interesting things that happened in the House. The Republicans, in the dark of night, at midnight, right before the government shut down, when they passed a rules change to the House rules. Ordinarily, any member of the House could make a motion to bring up a bill that has passed the Senate. It's in Rule 22, Clause 4 of the House rules. Unfortunately, essentially the Republicans passed a provision that would allow only the majority leader, Eric Cantor, or his designee to bring up a Senate-passed bill. So they severely restricted the ability of anyone in the Democratic Party or anybody in the Republican Party. Keep in mind there were 80-plus Republicans that were not pleased with the strategy and voted to reopen the government. Essentially, none of those individuals, Republicans or Democrats, could have brought the Senate-passed bill to the floor of the House because at the last minute, they fixed the rules and changed the rules in the House. That was the formal rule change. There's also an informal rule that the House follows called the Hastert Rule, named after former Speaker Dennis Hastert, which essentially says that the majority party will not bring a bill to the floor unless it enjoys majority support from the majority party. So unless you have a majority of Republicans on board, it won't go to the floor at all. Notwithstanding the fact that a bill could have bipartisan support. It could have a minority of Republican and a majority of Democratic support, but because of this informal rule, it still doesn't get an up or down vote. So it is interesting to see how those kind of games are being played, not just in the Senate, which have been written into the rules for a long time, but only abused really over the past 20 years or so, to the degree that we, you know, where everything is now subject to 60 votes. The House has traditionally not faced those kinds of problems, but we now have this informal Hastert rule, and we have the majority playing shenanigans with the rules and limiting the right of the minority to even bring bills up for a vote.
All right, so here we had, oh, government wasn't paralyzed enough. Now we have more rules paralyzing government even more, just what we needed here, Stephen.
That's right. You also have, I mean, and again, it's kind of hamstringing the President of the United States. The Constitution is clear that the debts have to be paid, that the debt of the United States, the full faith and credit of the United States, shall not be, you know, questioned in the 14th Amendment. The president would be put in a bind. I mean, he needs to faithfully, you know, defend the Constitution. But here you have a provision in the law where the debt ceiling, you know, exists, and at the same time he's required as a steward of the United States to pay the country's debts. It's kind of like having, I saw somewhere a good analogy, it's kind of like having a speed limit that says the speed limit is both 45 miles an hour and a speed minimum of 65 miles an hour. You can't have two laws on the book, one that says you need to drive 65 miles an hour and one that says you need to drive below 45 miles an hour. And that's essentially what is set up when you have this debt ceiling law, which is probably, nobody's challenged it yet. I know that there are certain members of Congress, including, I think, Congressman Grayson, who's considered, you know, suing over whether the debt ceiling statute itself is unconstitutional. It flies in the face of the Constitution. So it not only grinds, you know, Congress to a halt, but we've now seen it bring the entire government to its knees, you know, over disagreement over one bill, which passed, we've heard this time and time again, passed the House, passed the Senate. I'm talking about Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. Passed the House, passed the Senate, was signed by the President, was litigated at the Supreme Court, you know, was Exhibit A in the 2012 presidential election. And certain folks just could not accept the democratic process and decided to shut the whole thing down. So it's really a dangerous place to be. I'm hoping that they've learned their lesson. But I don't think we're by any means out of the woods yet. We could easily see this showdown happen yet again in January.
Indeed. Yes, we'll do it again. All right, so Common Cause, I guess one way to think about you guys is you are the lobbyists for the common people. And my understanding is that that's how government is supposed to work. The government is supposed to be responsive to the people. And I guess my question here is, you know, how are we going to fix this? And also that the government is also responsive to Wall Street, and Wall Street is getting kind of pushed out. So instead of having bipartisan compromises, et cetera, we have a small group of Tea Party people meeting in secret, deciding how the government is going to go.
Yeah, I think that's right. And notice, it's interesting to me that, you know, things finally came to a head when the debt ceiling was topic A, because that was making a lot of investors really nervous. And that's what, you know, it was the debt ceiling that really brought Republicans to the table and forced through a compromise. But, you know, in terms of, you know, people need to, you know, members, at first I thought to myself, you know, after they voted yesterday, members of Congress immediately left the Hill. You know, there was a lot of work. There's so much unfinished business. I mean, this is even less productive than the do-nothing Congress under President Truman. They've gotten really pretty much nothing accomplished. There have been no major pieces of legislation passed in this Congress, or frankly, the last Congress. And I thought, well, there's so much work to do. What are they doing going home? That said, members of Congress and senators are now home. They immediately left town, and they are in, you know, your districts, and they need to hear from their constituents that this cannot happen again, that they should not be patting themselves on the back for creating a crisis and then solving it themselves. I mean, this was an entirely artificial crisis. I think it's very clear who is to blame for this crisis without being partisan. Common Cause is a nonpartisan organization, but it's not partisan to show, though, to see clearly that it was a faction of the Republican Party that was holding the country hostage. And people need to hear from these members of Congress need to hear from their constituents when they're home. They need to hear from them at town hall meetings. They need to hear from them in phone calls and letters to their district office that this is unacceptable and that this is not what they sent them to Washington to do. And I know we say that time and time again, but this time they ought to be listening because of gerrymandering, because of the ability of self-serving political interests to draw the districts to draw members of Congress into safe districts. You know, there's been a lot of speculation that these members of Congress are not going to feel the pain that members felt back in the shutdown of 95 and 96. And so the only way they're going to feel it is to hear from their constituents, because a lot of them aren't nervous about the next election. They think that they're safe. They think that they did their constituents' bidding, which is, I think, not the case. And it's incumbent upon constituents to get in touch with their members of Congress while they're home for the next 2 weeks and let them know how this was really unacceptable.
All right, so let me just repeat what you said and go a little bit further here. So we have members of Congress who are voting being afraid of getting a primary challenge from the Tea Party.
Right.
And then at the same time, we have the Citizens United saying that money is free speech, and then the Mutchen versus the FEC going on so that becomes even more intense, so that rather than being beholden to the people of their own districts, they're beholden to a threat from the Tea Party of big bucks coming into their district and primarying them with a Tea Party person. So that they would not get elected that way. So we have then the intrusion of big bucks then swamping the will of the people, which goes back to what you were saying.
That's exactly right. You know, there was about $300 million spent in outside money in the 2008 presidential election before Citizens United. After Citizens United, this last 2012 election, we saw $1 billion of outside money. So it exploded exponentially how much money is being spent and can be zeroed in on particular districts. And that's exactly, I think, what was driving a lot of the thinking here, was that members of Congress, you know, they privately knew that this was a really bad for the country and a failed strategy, yet they were worried that they're going to, you know, get kicked out of office or primaried by an even more extreme faction of the party that would be funded by major outside interests. Maybe it is what brings Republicans back to the table to kind of fix what the Supreme Court did in Citizens United, because I'll tell you, politicians on both sides of the aisle do not like unaccountable money floating around in their campaigns, particularly when they don't know where that money is coming from. We don't have adequate disclosure. Citizens United, the Supreme Court assumed in Citizens United that we would have adequate disclosure on the books, that we would know where this money is coming from, in the words of the court, so that we could know if our elected officials are in the, quote, pocket of so-called moneyed interests. Well, we don't have that disclosure on the books because the Federal Election Commission is so broken, because it's very easy to funnel money through different entities behind phony names and never get to the true source of the money. Politicians actually don't like that. They want to know who is spending money in their race. So maybe we see a push for disclosure once people see the consequences of what unaccountable outside money does to our political system.
Yeah, some of the ideas about transparency originally came from the Republicans who are now against it. Boy, it's hard to fathom that switch. How do you negotiate with people that go against their own ideas when you adopt them?
Exactly.
All right. I wanted to also ask you about the EPA and something that's going on with the Supreme Court challenge. Before I do that and move on with that, let me just give you the opportunity. Anything else that you'd like our readers, our listeners here to know about this shutdown and sort of the workings of government, and if there's any way to fix this? Because many of us feel frustrated that, well, my $10 is going to be swamped by the Koch brothers' millions of dollars. What do we do?
I think it is, you know, what you hear so much about is that people aren't going to feel the pain from this shutdown, that members of Congress really aren't going to pay a political price for what they did. And they need to feel that by hearing from their constituents. But I might also challenge and challenge folks to also channel that into constructive action. In addition to, you know, speaking to members of Congress, speaking to the representatives, there's also some things that we need to get fixed. If there is this window of bipartisan cooperation now that the government is reopened and we've seen Republicans and Democrats finally, you know, at least vote on a bill to avert a crisis, it may sound like a non sequitur, but I think it's connected. You know, nothing's more important than the right to vote. The Supreme Court, you know, gutted the Voting Rights Act back in June. We need to fix that. And the Supreme Court laid out a roadmap to fix the Voting Rights Act and restore the rights of Americans to have their right to vote to vote unimpeded. That needs to happen. In 2006, it passed overwhelmingly with Republicans and Democrats. It passed the Senate unanimously and passed overwhelmingly in the House of Representatives. That's something that needs to happen again. We need to see another fix. So in addition to either thanking your member for standing strong and not voting to keep the government shut down, you know, or you know, having to slap your member of Congress on the wrist and tell them that, you know, you're appalled by what they did if they were voting to keep the government shut down, it's also important to say, you know, let's do something constructive and pass a fix to the Voting Rights Act. That is a must-pass piece of legislation, I think, as much as the debt ceiling was, quite frankly. So telling your member of Congress that the Voting Rights Act is critical and that needs to be fixed and that they have a bipartisan track record of fixing it is very important as well.
All right. I didn't ask you ahead of time, but I just want to ask your opinion. Are you at all familiar with the Supreme Court case, the Massachusetts versus the EPA? Is that something that you're following?
It's not something I have followed closely, but if maybe the facts of the case would ring a bell.
Okay, you know what, we'll come back to that because I don't want to spend time on things that you're not familiar with. What is the current situation with the Voting Rights Act? And you said that Congress needs to act here. We see a rash of states coming out with these draconian either lists to take people off of the voting registrations with these purging lists and different ID laws throughout the country right after the Supreme Court ruling. Is there a mechanism in place? Can you tell us, is there any, what's the legal implications?
So the Department of Justice is now suing, you know, we saw North Carolina immediately after the Voting Rights Act was struck down. North Carolina passed one of the most restrictive voter laws that we've seen in the country. It cuts back on early voting. It ends the rights of North Carolinians to register to vote on Election Day. It makes it easier so that people won't have their votes counted. It makes it easier for election officials to reject votes that are maybe cast in the correct county, in the correct town, but the wrong precinct because they've been misdirected or whatnot. Most dangerously requires a form of ID that we know from North Carolina's own records tens of thousands of people don't have. The Department of Justice came in. If the Voting Rights Act had not been struck down, that law would not be on the books. It would not be moving forward until North Carolina could prove that it would not prevent eligible voters from voting or did not pose a, you know, did not discriminate against voters. We've now seen the Department of Justice come in to sue under a provision of the Voting Rights Act that is still on the books that essentially says, you know, North Carolina intentionally passed this law to cut out certain voters, to discriminate against certain voters. And North Carolina has a long history of passing disturbing voting rights laws. And this law, you know, so North Carolina should be subject to what's called preclearance. It should mean that anytime North Carolina changes its voting laws, you know, the government should be, it should have to go to court. We can fix that. We can fix that law to make it easier to bail these jurisdictions into preclearance. We can pass a fix to, you know, the government said the data they used was too outdated, the data that Congress used in 2006 to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act. you know, was stale. Well, we can update that. We can do that, but we can only do it with a strong bipartisan Congress that hears from their constituents that this is something that they have to do.
All right, good. Thank you, Steve Spaulding. We're going to leave it there. Steve Spaulding, who's the legal counsel for Common Cause, talking to us and putting it together and what's going on in government there in Washington. You guys must be driven crazy up there, I would imagine. All right, thank you so much, Stephen.
Thank you. Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right, there we go. Steve Spaulding from Common Cause telling us how the government's supposed to work and how it was kind of hijacked. All right, guys, any comments on that, Tracy?
Well, I mean, it just goes back to, you know, it's almost everything we just had talked about was all because everybody disagreed about health care. And it all comes down to who takes care of mom, who takes care of grandma, and all this
stuff. You know, that's right.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny. I mean, as much dysfunction we have, you start looking at the cause of why everyone's arguing. It's
all
because
right.
We don't, yeah.
All right, so that's the end of our show. Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to WSLR 96.5, LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, your community radio station. The views and that you hear here are not those of WSLR's volunteers, its employees, or its board members, or anyone else, just to the people that gave them. Take what you like and leave the rest. And here's Complex Waveforms with Mark Zimpella coming up. Thank you for tuning in again. Thank everybody for contributing to our fund drive, which was very successful.